Welcome to the Hinckley Institute of Politics. My name is Hillary, and I will be the host for today's Hinckley Forum. The Hinckley Institute of Politics was established in 1965 through the generous bequest of the Noble Foundation and Robert H. Hinckley. This institute is dedicated to teaching students respect for practical politics and the principle of citizen involvement in government. The Hinckley Institute offers paid internships to students of all majors here locally in Washington, D.C., and in 35 countries around the globe. The Hinckley Institute also offers classes, the nation's only campaign management minor, week-long experiences in Washington, D.C., and over $70,000 in academic scholarships. We invite students to go next door or to our website, which is www.hinckley.utah.edu, for more information. Today's forum will be about Africa in transition, elections, and election-like. Our speaker will be Ambassador John Campbell, and just a little bit about him before he comes up. Ambassador Campbell served a U.S. Department of State Foreign Service officer from 1975 to 2007. He served as Ambassador of Nigeria and Dean of the Language School at the Foreign Service Institute. Notable assignments included Director from the Office of UN Political Affairs and Political Counselor of Nigeria and South Africa. He is author of Nigeria, Dancing on the Brink and writes a blog in Africa in Transition. So please help me with an applause in welcoming our speaker.
Thank you very much. It's a real pleasure to be part of the Hinckley Forum and to be at the University of Utah. Thank you so very much for inviting me. This afternoon, I want to share some thoughts on elections in Africa, but I promise you that as intoxicated as I am with the sound of my own voice, I'm going to leave time for your comments and your questions. I hope you won't be shy, because it's your comments and your questions that cause me, sometimes force me, to think about things in new and fresh ways. It's how I grow. Democracy is often defined by our political science friends as a political system under which the opposition has a reasonable chance of winning power through credible elections. I would also suggest that if it is to work, democracy must be conducted according to the rule of law. You can have justice and the rule of law without democracy. Think King Solomon. But as a practical matter, you cannot have genuine democracy outside the context of the rule of law. Without the law, democracy too often degenerates into tyranny, often by a small group that manipulates the majority in an electoral context for a narrow purpose. After all, Adolf Hitler came to power through a democratic electoral process, conducted according to the letter, if not the substance, of the law. Fundamental to American values are democracy and the rule of law together. And for us, elections are intrinsic to democracy. A free people going to the polls to choose the personalities who will represent and govern us. Our default position is that elections are almost always a good thing, and that there is a direct relationship between the ballots cast and who wins and who loses. But sometimes elections can be emptied of their democratic content. The form of elections may be maintained, but not its essence, which is the free exercise of choice. People go to polling stations and cast votes for particular candidates, but there may be no relationship between ballots cast and results announced. Or the electorate may be intimidated. Or it may be induced to vote a certain way by bribery. In such cases, the polling may be flawless, but it is no genuine election, and the process likely rides roughshod over the law. Instead of an election, it is an election-like event. Elections in the old Soviet Union, with communist majorities of 98%, come to mind. So too do too many elections in contemporary Africa. Because an election-like event looks like an election, it may be regarded as the real thing by the outside world. It may even be so regarded by the citizens of the country where the election-like event has taken place. Stalin's countrymen regularly described the Soviet state as democratic, citing regular elections as proof. And some of them actually believed it. A well-regarded Kenyan-American scholar, Kennedy Opalo, posits four types of African political systems, taking 2010 as his base. He lists 8 democracies, 5 emerging democracies, 21 consolidating or consolidated autocracies, and 12 as ambiguous. In the category of electoral democracies, he places Benin, Botswana, Cape Verde, Ghana, Lesotho, Mali, Mauritius, and South Africa. These countries are all characterized by real elections conducted according to the rule of law, and the results of the elections reflect the ballots cast. And the opposition sometimes comes to power. In 2012, Mali, with a civil war and an Islamic insurrection, moved out of that category, though the 2013 elections may herald better days. But the others still fit. Of the electoral democracies, only South Africa, with 50 million people, and Ghana, with 25 million, are large states. The other 6 are small, often with comparatively ethnically homogeneous populations. Of the states with larger populations than South Africa, Opalu posits Nigeria as ambiguous, and Ethiopia and Congo as consolidated autocracies. All 3 are characterized by election-like events and an inconsistent approach to the rule of law. This afternoon, I would like to look with a bit more depth at recent elections in Kenya and Nigeria. And if during the Q&A you would also like to talk about Zimbabwe, I would be happy to do so. Nigeria faces elections about a year from now. This year, there was an election in Kenya. Nigeria has a long tradition of election-like events. Kenya's reputation and history has been somewhat better. Kenya and Nigeria are important diplomatic partners of the United States. This means what happens in Abuja and in Nairobi directly impacts on U.S. national interests. In Kenya, the president and deputy president, duly elected in March, in what at home and abroad were regarded as free and fair elections. They are under indictment by the International Criminal Court at The Hague for crimes against humanity, not with respect to the 2013 elections, but rather with the last round of elections in 2007. Nigeria, as I've already said, faces elections in late 2014. They will take place in an environment of pervasive corruption. The most recent elections, those of 2011, were relatively peaceful, as they were in Kenya. But the results were nevertheless rigged, not at the polls, but at the collation centers. This is where the results from hundreds of polling sites are combined. And with honorable exceptions, the judiciary can be counted on to do the government's bidding when the election results are challenged in the courts. In Kenya, there has long been rivalry and bad blood between the Kikuyu and the Luo, the two largest ethnic groups. Their struggle for power and for land has shaped much of Kenya's post-independence political life. In the 2007 presidential elections in Kenya, the incumbent, Mwai Kibaki, a Kikuyu, and Raila Odinga, a Luo, each used ethnicity to an unprecedented extent to mobilize their supporters. The Kalenjin, another ethnic group, historically a rival of the Kikuyu, had allied themselves with Odinga, whose running mate was the Kalenja politician William Ruto. The polling proceeded peacefully, but when the results were announced, ethnic warfare broke out. At least 1,000 people died, and thousands more were displaced. As during the Rwanda genocide, in 2007, media played an important role in inciting ethnic violence in Kenya. Kikuyu and Kalenjin violence against each other was particularly brutal. The violence was so bad that there was international intervention coordinated by the UN Secretary General to patch together a political settlement. Part of that settlement included inviting in the International Criminal Court, the ICC, which indicted, among others, Uhuru Kenyatta, a Kikuyu standard bearer and the son of independence leader Jomo Kenyatta, and William Ruto for crimes against humanity. The violence was so traumatic that in the run-up to the elections of 2013, among Kenyans, there was a largely unspoken consensus of never again. No matter what the outcome, there would be no violence. And indeed, the 2013 elections were relatively peaceful. The Kikuyu candidate, Uhuru Kenyatta, won the presidency on a ticket that included as deputy president the same William Ruto who had challenged the Kikuyu candidate in 2007. A Kenyatta-Ruto ticket was a reversal of alliances, which a cynic might see as about personal power and ambition. The election results were challenged by the losing candidate, the same Raila Odinga, who had also lost in 2007. But instead of inciting his supporters to take to the streets, he took his case to the courts. They ruled against him. Odinga accepted the verdict. Uhuru Kenyatta and William Ruto were then sworn into office. A picture of democracy and the rule of law at work? Well, perhaps. Kenyatta and Ruto, indicted for crimes against humanity by the International Criminal Court in the aftermath of 2007, campaigned against the court in 2011, making it the cornerstone of their election campaign. They presented the court as Western, anti-African, prejudiced, meddlesome, and odious. The tactic seemed to work with some of the electorate, even though the International Criminal Court has heavy African representation among its justices and prosecutors, and it had been the Kenyans themselves that invited it in to investigate the 2007 post-electoral violence. The ICC was established by the Treaty of Rome and came into force in 2002. Kenya was an original signatory and, unlike the United States, has ratified it, accepting its legal jurisdiction under certain carefully defined circumstances. The use of a democratic process in Kenya, the presidential elections, to undermine the rule of law as represented by the International Criminal Court is a worry. Both Kenyatta and Ruto say they are innocent, and they have pledged to cooperate with the court and go to The Hague to stand trial. But essentially since the siege of the Westgate shopping mall in Nairobi at the end of September, both have argued that the fact that they were duly and democratically elected to office somehow trumps the ICC indictment. Democracy trumps the law. They say that an offshore trial has no popular resonance, serves no international or domestic purpose. Their supporters are arguing that peace is more important than justice, and that the International Criminal Court process should somehow or another go away. There is also credible evidence that Kenyatta's and Ruto's associates have been involved with witness tampering and intimidation. The International Criminal Court prosecutor has complained publicly about Kenya's lack of cooperation as required by the Treaty of Rome. Last week, she presented evidence that Kenyatta supporters were using bribery and intimidation against potential witnesses. At a special summit of the African Union last month, Kenyatta argued that the Western countries, especially the United States and the United Kingdom, had turned the court into a neo-colonialist tool. He called for a mass walkout from the Treaty of Rome. He argued that the court was contemptuous of the African Union, and subsequently, the African Union has resolved that neither he nor Ruto should go to The Hague to appear before the ICC. Kenya's parliament has already called for the country to withdraw from the Treaty of Rome. If it does so, it's difficult to see how the trials of Kenyatta and Ruto can proceed. If they do not, it will be a blow to holding African leaders accountable for their deeds, and therefore, and thereby, improve the quality of African governance. Archbishop Desmond Tutu, an icon of the South African liberation movement, recently said, quote, "The ICC has been a powerful force for justice, peace, and accountability, not just in Africa, but around the world. Far from targeting Africa, it has served and protected Africa," end quote. Be that as it may, the upshot of the Kenyan elections of 2013 is that the polling was peaceful and conducted according to the rule of law. But the larger issue of individual accountability of high political personalities has been undermined by the use of the elections and their outcome to bludgeon the court. Are the Kenyan elections a step forward, or are they a step backward for democracy conducted according to the rule of law? I would submit that the answer to that question is ambiguous. Nigeria is quite different. Nigeria's experience of national elections has not been happy ever since the restoration of civilian government in 1999 after a generation of military rule. They have been the occasion of elevated rates of violence, and their numerous technical flaws have facilitated blatant rigging, mostly by incumbents. The 2007 elections were worse than those of 2003, which were worse than those of 1999, which were so bad that former President Jimmy Carter left the country after speaking out about their blatant shortcomings and refused to endorse them. By 2007, in many, if not most parts of the country, there was little relationship between the balloting and the declared victor. National and regional politics remained an elite game that made little reference to the population of Nigeria, but used election-like events to promote the legitimacy of the system. In effect, during the 1999-2007 period, the cooperating and competing elites that run Nigeria determined who the next president would be within the ruling People's Democratic Party, and their choice was then rigged in. Opposition parties had little chance at the presidential level, though they could be successful in state and local contests. In the 2011 elections, the two leading presidential candidates were the incumbent president, Goodluck Jonathan, a Christian from the south, and Muhammadu Buhari, a Muslim from the north. During the run-up to the elections, both sides appealed to religious and ethnic identities. Unusual for Nigeria, the 2011 elections came to pit the Christian South against the predominantly Muslim North. On election day, the polling was significantly better than it had been in the past. Nevertheless, there was rigging, not at the polling stations, but at the point where the ballot counts were consolidated. When Jonathan's victory was announced, there was widespread rioting in the north. At least 800 people died. Further, the view was that the traditional northern elites, including the Sultan of Sokoto, the Emir of Kano, and the Emir of Zaria, had in effect sold out to President Jonathan rather than support the Muslim candidate. The mob burned down their private houses. The perverse consequence of the 2011 elections was to accentuate the religious split in the country, and it promoted the sense of northern alienation that directly feeds the indigenous jihadist insurrection known as Boko Haram. So, in Kenya, genuine elections have promoted attacks on the International Criminal Court and the principle of the accountability of high government officials. In Nigeria, improved polling in 2011 did not forestall rigging, and the elections encouraged the bifurcation of the country along religious lines. It remains to be seen what the consequences will be of the upcoming elections in late 2014. Now, looking at Kenya and at Nigeria and their experience with elections, the picture finally is not very pretty. Should we, in fact, give up on elections in Africa? I would submit that the answer is an unambiguous no. First, genuine elections, not election-like events, have helped consolidate democracy in countries such as Senegal, Ghana, Zambia, and Botswana, to cite only a few examples. Second, Africans themselves see elections as an essential ingredient in democracy. A reason why tyrants, such as Zimbabwe's Robert Mugabe, resort to election-like events is that Africans want elections. Third, even election-like events help promote the growth of a democratic civic culture. If nothing else, such events are a reminder of the possibilities of electoral democracy. Someday, if not today. The United States provides limited assistance to the elections process, usually through USAID and using implementing partners. Two of them are the International Republican Institute and the National Democratic Institute. These are independent, non-governmental organizations with close ties to their respective political parties. They receive an annual appropriation from the U.S. Congress. They work together very closely. In Nigeria, for example, NDI focused on voter education, while IRI works to help political parties build the necessary infrastructure. Both emphasize the importance of issue-based political campaigns. In addition, numerous non-governmental organizations with little or no contact with the U.S. government also support the electoral process in myriad ways. The Carter Center, based in Atlanta, is a particularly well-known example. So, too, is the International Visitor Program that has brought numerous experts on elections to the United States. Central to the International Visitors Program are individual non-governmental organizations that function on a local level. NDI, IRI, the Carter Center, and numerous other groups also provide election observers. I would maintain that outside observers frequently are unable to see what is actually going on. Nevertheless, they play a crucial role. They provide cover for local indigenous organizations to operate, and the latter do see what is going on. It was a Nigerian NGO that blew the whistle on the 2011 election rigging, and Zimbabwean NGOs that called out Mugabe's rigging of the 2013 election. But we should avoid the trap of seeing elections as always promoting democracy and the rule of law, as always a good thing. As we have seen in Kenya and Nigeria, sometimes they can have ambiguous, even opposite effects. With respect to elections, as with so much else, one size does not fit all in Africa. Generalization is difficult and quite often leads to oversimplification. Instead, we have to look at elections and election-like events, one case at a time. Africans want elections, and Democrats see them as essential to building democracy. And those rulers of Kennedy Opolo's consolidating autocracies will continue to find election-like events of use. So both are going to stay around. For friends of Africa and for policymakers, both in the U.S. government and in the private sector, the challenge will be to distinguish between the real thing and a charade. Thank you very much.
Okay, so now we will do questions. Just raise your hand. I'll have the mic with you. And then just make sure you state your first and last name before you ask your question.
My name is Vivian Nguyen, and earlier you talked about peace and justice. Which one do you think is more important, or do you think there's a compromise between the two?
No, I don't think there's a compromise between the two. And above all...
Master, will you stand at the mic?
I'm sorry, you couldn't hear me? Above all, I think it's terribly important to resist the assumption that you can compromise between peace and justice. That's a false dichotomy. And it's a dichotomy that those who favor neither peace nor justice will often try to force on us. They're clean different things. They reinforce each other. Without justice, you can have no peace. Peace is essential to justice. Yes, sir.
George Fafita. Question would be, historically, we know that Africa was they're influenced by some of the cultures of Great Britain and France.
Yes.
Other than the U.S. influencing the democratic process in Africa, are there any other aspects that they do influence in the continent of Africa?
The United States?
United States.
Yes. The biggest one by far is popular culture. The conventional way of referring to it as Coca-Cola culture. Hollywood is ubiquitous. Cell phones are now ubiquitous. A very large percentage of all Africans under the age of 40 would emigrate to the United States if they had the ability to do so. The cultural influence is massive and pervasive.
Hi, my name is Jordan Bowie, and I would like to ask you about the thought processes that one must go through in regards to, you were discussing, I believe it was Kenya, accusing the United States of using the International Criminal Court. I'd like to know how someone could come to that conclusion when the United States refuses to ratify the treaty because it will not allow itself to be subsumed under the Security Council. If you could elaborate on that.
Beats me. I mean, it is utterly and completely false. Where I think it comes from, the ounce of truth in the whole thing, is that the United States objectively supports the International Criminal Court and what the court tries to do. Further, the Assistant Secretary for African Affairs, in the run-up to the March elections in Kenya, said publicly that if a presidential and deputy presidential candidate, both of whom were indicted by the International Criminal Court, were to be elected president and deputy president, that was bound to have consequences. This would seem to me to be the most obvious thing in the world. However, it was viewed by a great many in Kenya as outrageous American interference in the internal affairs of Kenya.
My name is McKenna Nielsen. You talked about the rigging of elections. Was bribery a big part of that? And where did the money come from, if it was?
Yeah, it's a very good question. First of all, yes, absolutely bribery is a part of it. But the bribery is often fairly subtle. Now, at a local level, it can be as simple as simply handing out 500 naira bills to a Nigerian who is going into the polls. At a more elevated level, the bribery can take the form of, for example, shielding a statewide politician from prosecution for corruption by bringing pressure on the Attorney General not to prosecute. So lots and lots of different ways that bribery can operate. In Nigeria, elections are incredibly expensive. They're incredibly expensive because of the amount of bribery that goes on, and you end up with competitive bribery. Where does the money come from? In the case of Nigeria, at root, it comes from oil revenue. 94% of all of the revenue from Nigerian oil goes to the Nigerian government. And there is remarkably little transparency as to how that revenue is used or it's distributed.
My name is Brandon Nguyen. My question is, how has globalization impacted the areas that you've foreseen or have studied about, and how has globalization impacted the suffrage movements for women in Africa?
The difficulty there is sorting out what is the result of globalization, a kind of international movement that we can capitalize, and how much of it is the result of certain indigenous directions of development. Take, for example, the participation of women in electoral politics. Yes, that could be ascribed to reflecting globalization. But in Kenya, for example, where there are far more women in holding electoral office as a percentage than is the case in the United States, it also reflects a highly complex and indeed sophisticated way women have traditionally participated in public life. So sorting out globalization from other factors becomes difficult. I think you could probably argue that the intense popularity of elections in part reflects global influences. It particularly reflects the influence of the United States. I mean, everybody in Africa knows that Americans love elections, and Americans have them all the time, and elections actually mean something. Well, if the United States is still, and it is, to a remarkable extent, taken as the kind of model of what a free, democratic, developed country is, and if the Americans like elections, that means you do too. Does that help?
My name is Alice Riedessel. I'm studying social work, and my question for you is, what effect do you think religion and spirituality have on the people of Kenya and in the elections that go on there?
It has an immense impact on the people of Kenya, particularly the way they define issues. In fact, I would say it has an immense impact on people straight across the board in sub-Saharan Africa. In Nigeria, for example, an event such as this would always open with a prayer and it would close with a prayer. And it is virtually universally assumed that anything that happens is the result of divine will. So it's hugely important. Now, how does that translate into specific political issues? That gets quite complicated and varies a lot from one country to another. In South Africa, by far the largest Christian church is the Zion Christian Church. The Zion Christian Church traditionally has had absolutely nothing to do with politics, does not participate in political life at all. So it's going to be highly variable. There really is no secular state in sub-Saharan Africa that I could identify for you.
Hello, my name is Casey Levitt, and my question is, earlier you were saying that we should not give up on trying to get democracies to work in Africa. However, it can be seen throughout history that getting involved in other countries' business often results in wars which are expensive. Do you think trying to establish democracies that work there is worth the cost?
It's a very good point. It's an extremely good point. I think that the impact that outsiders can have on democratic development in sub-Saharan Africa is very much at the margins. In other words, we cannot bring about the creation of a democratic culture in sub-Saharan Africa ourselves. Some of us had that as a goal in Iraq, and look what a mess that ended up being. It's at the margins. Yes, we can bring people here to the United States under international visitors programs to show them what a democracy really looks like. Yes, we can provide technical assistance on how to build a political party. Yes, we can provide technical assistance on how to develop an effective voter education program. But we can't go much beyond that, in my view, and get anywhere.
Hi, my name is Ashley Madrigal, and a phrase you said earlier stuck with me, and it is, without law, democracy becomes tyranny.
Can become tyranny.
Or can become mm-hmm. tyranny. And so my question is, I guess you kind of answered it with him, does, like, how do you think corruption can be extracted from democracy effectively, and whether it should become, like, internally, or it should be, like, outside help? And I guess you kind of answered that.
Well, except it's a terribly important and terribly difficult question. Let's start with what corruption is. In the United States, if I get my brother-in-law a job at the State Department by dropping the good word on his behalf, and if that is found, I will go to jail. In most of sub-Saharan Africa, it is viewed as my obligation to do all that I can to get my brother-in-law a good job, because the highest allegiance is to your family, not to the nation. This is one reason why conversations about corruption between the first world and the developing world frequently break down. All of that said, in every sub-Saharan African country I've ever had anything to do with, there is a kind of corruption threshold which, when you cross it, everybody knows you have crossed it, and it's real corruption. That's very much the feeling now in Nigeria, for example, about the extent to which high government officials are involved in corruption. Okay, how do you eradicate it? Well, you eradicate it essentially by changing the culture and indeed the hierarchy of values. That takes an awful long time. And it also requires the people who are involved, it requires them to want to do it. And it's not altogether clear all the time that they do want to do it.
Hello, my name is Kurt Manwaring. I'm studying political science here. And my question for you is sort of twofold, and I want to kind of go back to the elections in Zimbabwe. Mm-hmm. After those elections were done, I recall listening to the BBC World Service and a governmental envoy of South Africa who had observed those elections was basically saying how fair and free and democratic they in fact were, when most people know that wasn't the case at all.
That's right.
So my question is, A, why would the biggest democracy in the region do that? But more importantly, B, what hope is there of actually advancing the goal of free and democratic elections in the region when the largest, most developed democracy is opposed to it?
Important question, and one that I've tried to reflect on a good deal. In some respects, what the South Africans did is even worse than what you said they did. It wasn't just the head of the electoral observers who endorsed the elections. President Zuma did himself. And further, the representative of the African Union, Nigeria's own Olusegun Obasanjo, who knows a thing or two about how to rig an election, he too endorsed the elections. Why did they do it? I think the answer is basically realpolitik. They couldn't do anything about the outcome of the elections. They were going to have to work with a Zimbabwean government for the next 5 years. And that their endorsement of those elections, in fact, reflected the fragility of their own particular political position. Now, you said, what hope can there be for advancing democracy if, in fact, the chief of state of the most democratic and most developed country in Africa endorses a blatant case of election rigging? Part of the answer to that is that South African civil society was outraged and called Zuma to task for it. In other words, you got an outpouring of public indignation that has an impact. It means that if Zuma tries to do something like this again in the future, he is likely to pay a high political price.
Hi, over here. My name's Sean Ranson. I'm a political science major. And my question was in regards to discussing kind of promoting the growth of democracy and minimizing the growth of false democracy or election-like events, how, in your opinion, what is the most effective way of incentivizing democratic institutions and genuine power sharing in Africa despite all of the incentives for election-like circumstances and stealing power?
Two ways. The first is by outsiders supporting those indigenous African groups that are working for genuine democracy, and there are a lot of them. The second is to keep the flashlight on and not in our own rhetoric accept the unacceptable. We're better than that in some cases than in others. We've been quite forthright about the elections in Zimbabwe. We were extremely mealy-mouthed, and I would even say cowardly, over the Nigerian elections of 2007.
Hi. Hi. My name is Mo Leguan. I'm a French major here at the University of Utah. And my question is, you had mentioned that religion and even associations with tribes have a lot to do with the democracy in different countries in Africa. What do you think are ways that we can help them get over or go over that cultural struggle they have when someone from outside their religion or outside their ethnicity is elected? Because you know how sometimes it causes wars or genocides and stuff like that.
As it did in 2007 in Kenya.
Yeah.
I think, first of all, what outsiders can do is extremely limited. But I do think that outsiders should respect the African concerns over ethnicity and religion as opposed to simply dismissing it as somehow or another not democratic or not modern. We make a great mistake when we minimize the authenticity of African religious beliefs.
Hi, my name is Ellie Morales. I heard you touch on Senegal earlier, and I was just wondering which of the four political categories does Senegal fall under?
I would put Senegal now in the category of a constitutional democracy. That's following the most recent elections, where not only were the elections well conducted, but the opposition won. And the fact that he won was accepted.
Hi, my name is Nisha Kavalam, and my question is, in the election-like events, are there patterns of organizational campaigning, or are they not genuine because individuals running for election are relying on the rigging or bribery?
There are usually organizations. In fact, there almost always are. Normally, there are government or incumbent-sponsored political parties that provide the muscle for the rigging. It's rare that an individual simply stands back and presumes that rigging will do the job entirely.
Hi, my name is Jesse Buchanan. I'm a biology major here. For a country like Mali, who was democratic and then had unrest troubles and now is being protected by a UN mission with France, how would you say would be the best way to help democratic nations that have unrest that need help before they fall?
Mali is quite fascinating from that perspective. In the list of democracies that I reeled off at the beginning of my formal remarks, Mali was on there. For the past 15 years in Washington, Mali was the poster child for African democratic development. Well, we now all know that that wasn't the reality. The reality was that Mali was being run by a relatively enclosed group of elites who essentially regularly rearranged the deck chairs on the Titanic and did not address the profound alienation of the northern half of the country. Mali is a classic case of how blind we are when we decide that there's a kind of paradigm, in Mali's case, Mali is becoming a democracy, and just assume that, okay, we're not going to have to look any more closely at it. I am more pessimistic about Mali now, following the latest elections, than conventional wisdom allows for, because I think those elections were also nothing more than the rearrangement of the deck chairs on the Titanic. And lo and behold, there has been a resurgence of jihadist violence in the northern part of Mali, with particularly the French withdrawal. In other words, problem not solved.
Hi, I'm Brandon Kenny, political science major. I was just wondering if you would comment on recent elections in Algeria and whether or not they are legitimate, as, for example, Hillary Clinton praised them as being legitimate, or, like others have said, not legitimate, such as people, observers of the election in the press.
I'm going to cop out, but not really. The Council on Foreign Relations, like the State Department, does not regard Egypt, Libya, Algeria, Tunisia, or Morocco as part of Africa. It regards them as part of the Middle East. And therefore, I have never paid any particular attention to Algeria, and I know nothing more about it than what you would get from reading in the New York Times. That said, I'm perfectly prepared to advance an opinion, which is, within an Algerian context, I think Hillary Clinton's characterization of them was right. But it means that we have to accept that there's very little in common between Algeria's politics and those of, say, Utah or Vermont, and that includes the elections.
So unfortunately, that's all the time we have for questions, and we just want to thank our generous speaker for his time today.
Thank you. Anybody who wants to talk about the career in the Foreign Service, I'm happy.